Hello, I'm Owen Edgerton. Welcome to KUT's podcast, The Write-Up with Owen Edgerton. We're here at South by Southwest in the heart of beautiful Austin, Texas, where Texas has been invaded by filmmakers and tastemakers and music aficionados and a bunch of people who believe it's always 75 degrees, blue skies, and beautiful in Austin, and there's free queso and beer everywhere, which is true. This is how we live every day of the year in Austin, Texas. We are having a live podcast here, and I'm so excited for our guest, who is C. Robert Cargill, known to everyone, friends and enemies, as simply as Cargill. Cargill and I grew up in a scene here in Austin, Texas, that took place in the first decade of the 2000s, which was a celebration of geek culture, film, and all things fun. It kind of revolved around two different poles. He and I both doing similar kind of stuff, similar kind of work in both those poles.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, the Alamo Draft House, where I was mocking movies with the Sinus Show and Master Pancake Theater later on, and Ain't It Cool News, where Cargill was reviewing films, and also at Spill, where you reviewed films as well.
Oh, yeah.
And that scene was fantastic. Geek was cool. Comic books were talked about.
Parking was free.
Parking was free.
$30.
Yeah.
It cost $30 to park in Austin today.
I know. So luckily your career has managed to make you be able to afford maybe not rent, but parking.
Yes. Well, that's where I'm living now is in eight-hour parking.
Once you pay $30, you don't leave that spot for a month. Cargill was a celebrated film critic for a decade, a little more of a decade, and then late-night drinks in Las Vegas with director and writer Scott Derrickson. Cargill pitches an idea, which is terrifying. Within a matter of months, that movie has been paired up with Jason Blum and Blumhouse Productions, and Sinister is being made, which I believe to be one of the scariest and best horror movies of the 2000s, of this millennium.
Thank you.
This young millennium. Since then, Cargill has gone on to write a number of works with Scott Derrickson, including Sinister 2, and most recently, Doctor Strange, the highly anticipated Doctor Strange. It's really a pleasure to have Cargill here on The Write-Up, and we're going to talk about all things film and Cargill.
Awesome.
And Cargill, I should also mention, is a celebrated novelist. Your third novel is going to be coming out in the series, right? What is the new novel that you're coming out with is?
I've written and published two novels.
Yes. Dream of Shadows and Queen
of the Dark Things.
Yeah.
That third novel is coming up. That should be out hopefully maybe late next year.
Ooh.
I still have to write it. I'm working on a science fiction standalone called Sea of Rust right now.
Right.
Which you've heard a page from.
I love it.
At your one page salon. And that's what I'm finishing up, like, literally at the moment. Like, I was up late writing last night, went to bed a little earlier than I normally do to get up, do some high-octane coffee, and race down here to pay $30 to park to, you're going to hear that a lot today, by the way.
You're really a stickler for this parking.
I hit that moment of age where you start, like, $30 to park?
Bicycle, Cargill.
Yeah, I know.
Stop whining.
Bike across the city.
Yeah.
So I came down here to do, and when I go home, I'm going to make myself another pot of coffee, Costa Rican this week.
Mm.
My wife just got back from Costa Rica, and she's like, I'm sorry I didn't bring you anything but coffee, and I'm like, what? You brought me Costa Rican coffee, fresh from Costa Rica. That's amazing. So I'm going to go home, make a pot of coffee, and write, put the final work into that book. And then when I'm done with that, then I go into writing the third book, which is the third Colby Stevens book of the Dreams and Shadows and Queen of the Dark Things, called The Coyote Laughs Last.
Oh, that's fantastic. I do want to talk about that. I want to talk about the whole genre of urban fantasy. But before we do that, I want to talk a little bit about scary movies. I was thinking about Sinister recently. I love Sinister, and I know I've mentioned that to you several times. I've watched it over and over again, it is one of those movies that, from the beginning, and as a filmmaker and as a horror fan, we do get to this place where we're no longer terrified by movies in the way we were when we were 12 and we stumbled upon Night of the Living Dead on TV.
Mine was Nightmare on Elm Street.
Was it? Yeah.
The first.
That's what I was going to ask. What was the first movie that terrified you?
Nightmare on Elm Street. I was sleeping over at a friend's house. I was 10 years old, and we were changing channels, and on HBO, it was the Johnny Depp bed scene.
Yes.
From Nightmare on Elm Street, where he's asleep on the bed, and the arm comes up out of the bed and pulls him in, and then there's the gusher of blood. That was my introduction to horror movies. I could not sleep for days after that, and I was hooked.
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually a great movie, Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yes, it is.
It is really a fun one to return to. When I first watched Sinister, I loved how terrified I was in the opening scene. I started watching it and I was like, it was a sense of dread, and that was a reason for celebration for me. I was like, look at this, woohoo! I love horror movies again. But I was going to ask you. So it was Nightmare on Elm Street. What were some of the other ones? Like when you're a kid, that same thing, flipping through, you see it on cable. You don't want your parents to know you're watching it. What were those horror movies for?
Oddly enough, the one that really, really messed with me the most outside of Nightmare on Elm Street was Damien the Omen 2.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, no, like, yeah, you would think the Omen, because,
right?
Yeah, because the Omen is the significantly better film, but 2's really good, and 2 is really scary, and it's about, like, a 13-year-old boy who is the devil, which I saw when I was, like, 11, so it's like, he's the slightly older devil bully, like, that was terrifying.
Yeah.
Like, that scared the crap out of me.
And he doesn't necessarily want it. That, of course, has the frozen ice scene.
Yeah.
Which is pretty... pretty horrific.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. So, needless to say, it's it was that. Those were the two that really connected with me. There's a couple other interesting horror movies from that era. I mean, I fell in love with them. Like, I would watch anything I get my hands on.
Yeah.
You know, I'd literally go to the video store and just be grabbing whatever, because my parents were like, if there's no boobies in it, you can watch it. Like, that was, it was a very American household.
Yeah.
Where, you know, it's just like, people get cut in half with chainsaws. That's great. A touching story of love in which a boob is revealed. No, you're not allowed to watch that. So
thank God. Thank God your parents took care of you.
Yeah. So I watched. And I had a buddy who was that comic book horror cliche from the late 80s. Like, he was that 13-year-old kid who was just, you know, all amped up on sugar. And, like, you got to see this videotape. I found this thing at 4 in the morning on Showtime. I have to show you. And we'd go over and spend the night at his house on, like, Friday night. And we'd just stay up watching this crazy stuff that he found. And that was kind of my introduction to those kind of movies. So there's so much of that in that era that all kind of clumps together. Like, the one night I went over to his house and he's like, hey, let's watch all 7 Friday the 13th movies.
There was only 7 at the time, huh?
At the time. Yeah, because it was right. He was getting all geared up for Jason Takes Manhattan.
Yes.
Like, I've just dated myself. Like, there's people going, wait a second, 7?
You know, though, that there was something, for me, the film school I went to was, for me, the Alamo Drafthouse and video stores, like Vulcan Video.
Yeah.
Here in Austin. But the video stores also in my hometown, which is a similar thing, I would just go, I loved all those straight-to-video movies, and I would just pick them up and just stare at their covers and think, this is just too cool and weird. And, you know, the straight-to-video market did some wonderful things for horror.
Oh, yeah.
Because they started doing things that the studios weren't doing, that wouldn't dare to do. And
for good reasons and bad.
Exactly, yeah. And they were making them fast. They were fast and a little bit out of control.
Oh, like the full moon pictures.
Yeah.
That they're a great example where, you know, it's like, really? You made like 20 movies out of killer puppets?
Right.
And they're like, yeah, aren't they great?
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, but you know what? Those movies are stupid fun.
They're stupid fun. I completely agree.
You know, it's funny, tying all this together, because you talked about how at the beginning, you know, how you and I came up together in, you know, the early Austin scene.
Yeah.
And one of the greatest things... Like,
I love that we're referring to the 2001 as the early Austin scene.
Well, this scene evolved, in, you know, as out of the draft house.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's always been creatives in Austin. And there have been different scenes in Austin.
Right.
And you could run into different people on different scenes. Like, we have a great writer here in town, Ernie Klein, who's a wonderful human being. And I got to know Ernie on the slam poet circuit.
Right.
Like, when he would do slam poetry at Electric Lounge. And the first time I did slam poetry here in Austin, I got blown thrown off the stage by him on the Electric Lounge, which is like saying all of those words together is like, wow, you would have had to try hard to find a more Austin sentence than Ernie Cline blew me off the stage at Slam Poetry at the Electric Lounge in 1998.
That's like, so true.
But so, yeah, no, it like,
and of course, Ernie Cline, for listeners, went on to write Ready Player One, among other things, which is Spielberg is going
Steven
to be
Spielberg's
going
making
to be
that.
Directing.
Yeah. No, but so that's the scene evolved out of this crazy thing. It's weird. This one purchase kind of it blew up this whole scene in which Tim League, owner of the Alamo Drafthouse, went out and bought 200 movies from a failed drive-in. And just said, you know what? We need to run these things. Why don't I show one a week every Wednesday night at midnight? I won't charge anybody anything to come in. We'll sell food and drink, and we'll just show this crazy thing and not promise that it's any good.
Right.
And so a bunch of us started going and getting to know each other. And then Master Pancake, or back when it was Mr. Sinus, would do stuff like on Wednesday nights sometimes.
Yeah.
And so a bunch of us would go and catch the Mr. Sinus show and then stick around for Weird Wednesday.
Right.
And like this whole scene just evolved of people who knew each other there and people who have been friends for 15 years. Like, it's weird to think that I saw my first movie at the Alamo Drafthouse and first met Carrie League tearing tickets on the staircase of the old Colorado thing back in 98, and here I am in 2016. If she'd had a baby that day, I could legally have sex with that baby now. Like, that is how long ago that was.
My goodness.
See, that's context that's, you can understand.
Yes,
you can
thank
fathom
you
that.
For really grounding. I was
See, you know the league so well that all of a sudden it just went into a weird territory.
It sure does. I bet if Tim League's listening now, he's turning it off.
It's like, God damn it, Cargill.
But you're totally right. There was this gravitation to a film, and it actually, Vulcan Video and I Love Video were a bit part of that as well.
Yeah, I worked at I Love.
Did you?
Yeah, I was an I Love guy.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
that's fantastic. And it was part of the scene of where people were celebrating something different about film. They were getting into those. I mean, I totally remember when Tim bought that whole slew of films and didn't know what they were.
Yes, some of them were stuff that you knew right away. You're like, oh my God, we have a print of that. And then some of it was like, can I do it until I get glasses?
Yeah.
The obscure, like, 1975 skit comedy movie, only known by historians because it's the first film appearances of Robin Williams.
Really?
And they're terrible. Like, there's like you're watching scenes with early, very young Robin Williams going, yeah, he needs a little polishing.
That's fantastic. You know, I think too, I've been thinking about horror films in American tradition. And of course, film critics and fans agree, this has kind of been two golden eras of American horror. So the first, oh my gosh, I think that's God is talking to us at South By.
It's God, Kent.
So the first era, like the 1930s, with the Universal horror movies, Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, Invisible Man, Dracula, all those. And then the second would be late 60s, but basically the 70s, right? And I was thinking, like, well, so what are the markers of American horror? And for me, it's sort of two.
I would actually disagree with that assessment, but let's go on. But you go ahead and lay out your argument.
Right, so my thought is of American horror has basically, right now, has two parents. The grandparents, I'm going to say the Dracula and Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein specifically, are the grandparents. And then, of course, some amazing silent stuff, too. But in the 70s, there was these two. And they're my favorite horror movies, and they're two different styles. One is The Exorcist. Now, The Exorcist is crafted, beautifully made, high-budget film. And there's an element in it that keeps jumping outside of the box that you expect for that kind of movie. Like, I understand the kind of movie I'm watching. I understand these actors are bigger actors. I know what's going to happen in this kind of movie. But then you have a kid who's saying things like, no, 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 your children aren't allowed to say that, and you can't do that with a crucifix. And it's jumping out of the box, which is an element of the terror as a viewer. The other one is Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Texas Chainsaw Massacre has no box. It is, I don't trust the filmmaker when I watch it. It's grainy. The camera kind of works in a weird way. And I don't know any of these names. And I feel the clumsiness of the acting. And it makes it more terrifying because I don't trust, when I'm first watching that the filmmaker is going to take care of me. They could do anything. Which is one of the things I love about some of the Weird Wednesday movies and some of the straight-to-video movies, that there are filmmakers who I don't trust in the way that I do trust something that's coming out of Hollywood. They're not going to do anything too crazy. They don't. That's their job. But there's this other element of horror where they are. They who knows what they're going to do? Crazy people are behind the camera.
Well, yeah, that I would agree with you on the 30s, and I would not include the 60s. I would say that it was the early to mid 70s that I think is a real golden age.
What about Night of the Living Dead? I'm starting with Night of the Living Dead.
Okay. I'll give you that Night of the Living Dead might kind of be the start of it.
Yeah.
Because you're right, there is a branching element of horror movies in that era.
Right.
You have one branch of it, which is these are films.
Yes.
Like this is cinema.
This is
we
cinema.
Are making high art horror movies, and that's your Exorcist, that's your Omen, that's your Burnt Offerings, we're putting real money into making real movies. These are movies that kind of came out of Rosemary's Baby.
Rosemary's Baby, and maybe even before that, Psycho. They're all like from Psycho on. Like, we're serious about horror.
Films.
Yes.
And then you have the dirty, nasty movies that kind of originate with Night of the Living Dead, and then move on to, as you mentioned, Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Last House on the Left.
Yeah.
The one where it's just like, there are no rules. We're literally making this movie in a backyard.
And it's terrifying because of that, because you don't trust that this person's not going to show you something that's going to hurt your soul forever.
Yeah, and then they kind of branch off, and then we get Grindhouse.
Yeah.
And guys like us have a love of Grindhouse, but the Grindhouse era wasn't particularly good.
Right.
It was literally, people were cranking out movies as so that they could get play in these movie theaters that were literally showing movies around the clock.
Yes.
Like how Grindhouse theaters work, a lot of people forget about it. They think it's kind of a style rather than an actual era. But what happened was you'd have these movie theaters that would be showing movies 24 hours a day in certain large cities, and they would never stop. You would just buy a ticket and walk in and watch until you were done watching and then go out. And so they would literally just be, they play a movie and then they play a few shorts or a cartoon or a newsreel and then move into, the next movie.
Right.
And they were making these super cheap movies to go into that. So those two eras are big. I would also say that the 80s slasher era, particularly from the early 80s to the mid to late 80s.
Is another golden era?
Is a golden era because it was, those movies were making a lot of money and legitimizing horror and giving voices to a lot of young talent.
Oh,
and when people talk about horror movies, they have invariably go back to Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah.
They talk about Friday the 13th. They talk about the Halloween movies. They talk about, some of the lesser known horror slasher fare of that time. Like really great stuff like My Bloody Valentine.
Yeah.
I would call that a separate golden age because that, that first golden age, that second golden age, the one in the 70s, really got clipped by Grindhouse, and then this kind of came back and brought it back. And then, of course, it died again in the late 80s when it became all about campiness and goofiness, and then had completely died off until 96 when we saw probably one of the beginning of one of the worst eras of horror filmmaking, which was
Scream?
The post-Scream, post-modern, let's put a bunch of pretty people in a movie and watch them die, but you're not ever going to watch this movie again kind of fare. But then I would argue that we are just coming out of another golden era.
I agree. And it's always hard to know. I think I agree with everything you say there. And it's interesting. By the way, just so a reminder, you're listening to KUT's podcast, The Write-Up with Owen Edgerton. We're at South by Southwest 2016 here in Austin, Texas. And I'm talking to C. Robert Cargill, novelist, screenwriter, and occasional slam poet.
Back in the 90s, we were all slam poets.
Yeah.
I mean, we all had business cards that said slam poet on it. It was a thing.
It was a glorious thing.
Let's admit it. Let's acknowledge that we went on stage and spoke in a very certain staccato.
I sure did. Chicago House. That's where I would Oh boy.
It's, hey, look, you know, it's kind of funny to look at in retrospect, but that's how you and I got to learn how to work a mic.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where a lot of people that I know that came up and did radio shows or are doing podcasts or would go out in front of crowds. You learn how to do that by going up and sucking terribly.
Yes.
And writing about teenage angst and your anger over not having a good job.
Yeah.
Like, that's what we did.
And it's a brilliant thing to fail in front of an audience, because you quickly learn, oh, just because I liked what I wrote doesn't mean it's good. And I thought it was good when it was in my journal, and now I've shared it and I realize it's not good. I'll cut that out next time and write something better.
Oh, yeah. Here, let me do a little...
You're going to do some slam poetry?
Let me do a little aside. Let me tie all of these elements together.
Okay, because then I want to go back to the horror movie.
Oh, you know what? Let's go back. Let's talk about that. That's far more interesting, and we're out of time.
But I want to... No. I want to hear how you're going to bring it together.
Okay. I'll tell that story.
Okay.
I'll cap off this episode with that story.
Fantastic. I love what you were saying about the movies. It's funny, the trajectory that you just mapped out, going from the 70s through Grindhouse, through the slasher films, and then into the Scream and post-Scream era. Fascinating that Wes Craven's, who made Nightmare on Elm Street, was a part of so many of those movies. I mean, Last House on the Left.
Oh, yeah.
And then, of course, Sean Cunningham, which was his first. And then Sean Cunningham, who was involved with that, well, went off and made...
He went off and watched
Friday
Halloween
13th.
Said,
yeah.
That's brilliant. I'm going to do it with a hockey mask. Made the Friday the 13th movies. Although the hockey mask doesn't show up till the third one.
Third, right.
But yeah, for years he denied it. But later came out and said, yeah, we were just ripping off Halloween.
Of course, of course. I love that he denied it, really.
Yeah, no, Wes Craven was at the forefront of every single one of those movies.
And then, of course, Scream is Wes Craven. Yeah, that's an amazing...
He never got into torture porn.
He never did. No, that's interesting.
Because for those of you playing along with the home game, it went with the post-Scream era, then it went into torture porn, and then into the era we're about to talk about.
That's right. And actually, Wes Craven's had this interesting... experience when they were making the remake, which he served as a producer, remake of The Hills Have Eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And
which I really like that movie.
Me too. And the director had said, we need to do this one scene. How about we have this scene where one of the villains puts a kitten in a blender and then drinks it? I know, horrible. And he went to Wes and he's like, we should do this. And Wes said, no, we cannot. People might try it. And it was interesting to see Wes Craven, who's given all kinds of horrible things and put on the screen, that was his
Where's
line.
Where's the line in the sand? At things that people would actually try.
Right.
Like, really, it's not hard to get kittens. Like, if you... You just put out a little food on your deck, and a pregnant cat will come up, and you'll have plenty of blender experiments.
Oh, no.
Show up.
No.
And that is not, who wants that on their conscience?
I want to point out that KUT in no way endorses blenders, kittens, or any marriage of the two.
Oh, they endorse kittens, I'm certain.
Oh, that's true.
Blenders
like kittens.
And kittens is where we draw
that's
the
right.
line today.
That's right. The ingredients are fine. It's the combination that where everything goes south. So then, let's talk about the
we'll go South by Southwest.
Oh, look at that. Nice plug.
Because
South by Southwest needs a plug.
Yeah.
They're struggling.
They're only charging $30 for parking. It's a bargain.
So we're talking about the horror movie evolution or trajectory. And now we're in the 2000s and we're in Sinister. We're in the world of Sinister. So.
Well, yeah, but really, it's 2007, mm-hmm. when Paranormal Activity shows up.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, people are like, ooh, ghost stories.
Ghost stories.
We love ghost stories.
Right.
And, it's Martin Thomas is sitting out there. He's like, wait, what is that? It's the voice of Cargill.
Hi, Martin.
Yeah. What one of our good friends happens to have copped a squat right next to where we're recording, having no idea what's going on.
My goodness, the visuals that we're giving people in this podcast are fantastic.
Copped a squat means sitting down.
I'm sure it does. Okay, so Paranormal Activity.
So Paranormal Activity. Just
Jason
kind of
Blum, who's also the producer of Sinister and Sinister 2. Yes, who really believed in Paranormal Activity and said, I've seen this movie. It should not be a direct-to-streaming or direct-to-video. It should be bigger, and does a brilliant job of bringing it to secret screenings and building the buzz. And, of course, it becomes not only a huge film made for a budget, which about the similar budget to what you paid for parking today.
Yeah.
But also, then what, I think there were 7 Paranormal Activity films in the end. Is that right?
They're still making them.
Really? I thought the last one was the...
I thought there was another one planned.
Oh, really?
I have no idea how many those there's going to be.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, we're seeing an era where all of a sudden, you know, people, they have finally found a name for it, and I've only started hearing the name for it over the last year.
What's that?
People call them ghost house movies.
Ghost house movies.
I wish we had that like 5-10 years ago, and you know, that phrase would have been very useful. Oh, it's not a horror movie, it's a ghost house movie.
I like that very much.
No, I do too, but everybody's referring to these ghost house films.
Which are films that have a paranormal activity, or they have a supernatural element.
They have sinister paranormal activities.
They are made for a respectable budget, hovering around less than $1 million to $5 million at the tops, and often can be a PG-13. Would those be the elements that sort of?
Yeah. No, the driving elements are story, character, and just creeping around in the dark.
Well, I want to talk to you about you as a writer in that. One of the things that Jason Blum compliments you and Sinister that he so enjoys is to say that if you took all the scares out of Sinister, if you took all the jump moments, jump scares, the horrific elements, everything that's scary, you would have a beautiful Sundance drama. Like, you would have a film that works because of the characters, the interactions of the characters, that is outside of the elements that make it a horror film. So I want to ask you about that. How do you find your character's story when you are entering into a script?
Well, I mean, I'm somebody who starts with the idea.
Mm-hmm.
So I go with the idea and I ask myself, what type of character ends up in this story? With Sinister, it was really tough because it was one of those things that I tried for a very long time to find the character, because the character concept was obvious from the beginning and it was too obvious. And it's one of those things that I harp on writers who write about writers.
Yes.
Because it's like, could you get a little lazier? I'm writing about a writer. No, it's not about me. and I was like, I'm not going to write about a writer, but I could not come up with anyone that would justifiably not turn over these film reels to the police.
Right.
That the audience didn't hate. Like, that was the thing, was you could put almost anyone in there, but the audience would not connect with that character. I needed a real impetus where the moment we look at his decision, we understand what's going through his head. There's actually a silent moment there where Ethan Hawke is kind of looking at his bookshelf, and you know the thoughts in his head. You know what's going on at the moment.
Yeah.
So what I do is I ask myself, what kind of character gets in here? And now that I have the type of characters that are in here, what makes them interesting and compelling?
Yes.
What makes them different? What makes them make a choice that makes the audience go, oh, wait a second, this is somebody I'm interested in? Because that's the thing, is the story is very important to telling a story. You know, you need to have some kind of core through line that the audience can follow through. But the reason why an audience gets invested in a movie or a book is because of the characters, because they want to see what happens to the characters. The big line of delineation between a really good horror movie and a really bad horror movie is that a really good horror movie takes real characters and puts them in danger. A really bad horror movie takes characters you don't care about and goes, watch how we kill them.
Ah.
And like, that's all the movies we talked about that are the really great movies, you know, we talk about The Exorcist. You care about Reagan and her mom.
Yeah.
You care about the priests. We talked about Nightmare on Elm Street. You care about Nancy. You know, Wes Craven did this brilliant thing where the first 2 minutes of the movie we spend with this girl. And then from that point on, we spend the next 10 minutes with her and her best friend, fully unaware that the girl we're spending the first 10 minutes of the movie with is not the protagonist.
Right.
The protagonist is the best friend. So we watch her die and we're like, nobody's safe. And we start caring about Nancy.
Yeah, a Hitchcock move. The Psycho move.
And then you watch a movie like Nightmare on Elm Street 3, where, you know, we put all these characters in a mental institution and they're all really messed up because of their sleep problems. And we care about them. And then we watch them die and we're terrified for them. And then you watch like 5, where it's like, let's put a bunch of cliches together and have Freddy kill them off as Freddy's cackling, because that's why we watch it, right?
Yeah.
No, that wasn't why we were watching it. We watch horror movies because we want to be invested and we want to be scared, because we as people are the stars of our own story. Mm. And if we can feel like these characters are real and have their own stories like our story, that we can exist in that universe. And we for a moment make that connection. And so with Sinister, that was something we very much sat down and did. We said, we want these characters, we want this family to be real. We want this to be a story that is as much about the breakdown of the American family and the compulsion of someone driven towards their desire for fame and their desire for success. We wanted to tell that story as much as we wanted to tell a story about a guy sifting through snuff movies.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to marry those together so that you were terrified of what might happen at the end. So when that third act happens, you are on the edge of your seat going, you're like Robert Downey Jr. in Tropic Thunder. Survive! You know, it's you want to have that connection for that to work. And that's where I approach my characters, is I ask, is the audience going to be compelled to be interested in this person in particular?
Yeah.
Are they going to make interesting choices that the audience is going to go, oh, I wouldn't have done that. I want to see how this plays out. But at the same time, stay invested to get through to the end of the story.
Yes. Yeah. Well, then let me ask you this. When you've got your character, you've got them involved and invested in the story, where do you find these nightmares? When you are crafting the horrors, whether it's in Sinister or in one of your novels, where do you find those fears and those nightmares?
Literally, the opening scene of Sinister that you discussed came from a nightmare.
Mm.
I literally had a nightmare one night in which I wandered it. I went into my attic. I found a box of 8mm films. I spooled one up, and I saw the opening scene from Sinister.
And for those of you who have not seen Sinister, the opening scene is it's really disturbing. It's a family.
It's a parking bill for $30.
It's just a parking bill. A slow zoom on a parking bill.
In Super 8.
It's really horrible.
It's what we call a callback.
But it's a family being hung from a tree outside, and it's being
with sacks over their heads.
With sacks over their heads, and slowly dying, and it's on 8mm film, grainy, and you can't see who's doing the damage, and it's terrifying. It's really terrifying. So nightmares. I honestly dreamed that. And what about other things?
After that, it's just it's all about asking yourself what scares you.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it scares you, it scares other people.
Yeah.
If it doesn't scare you, there's a chance that someone else isn't going to be scary. I think that's one of the problems a lot of horror filmmakers make, is they go, well, I don't think this is scary. I don't think these films are scary. But this is what typically scares people. This element is scary.
Yeah.
And no, that's not how you write horror. You have to, it has to scare you. And I spend a lot of time up at night. In an odd, cruel twist of fate, I have very sensitive skin. I burn just driving across town. And so I, you know, my schedule crept more and more into nights in which I go to bed at 7 a.m. So yeah, the rest of the world is asleep, and I'll go out for walks at night in the dark, and you ask yourself, what do you see there? Like,
yeah,
what's there? What are you afraid of? What's messing with you?
Yeah.
And I find that where I really go for horror is I like monsters that develop character. Like, I'm not so much into monsters that, you know, I really want to kill teenagers with a machete, or I want to eat you. I like monsters that force you into very tough decisions that play with that make you question who you are, that play around with your own sense of self. That's what scares me.
Yes.
What scares me is the idea that a monster would put me into a situation that I would do something terrible that I wouldn't ordinarily do. I think that's why so many people are fascinated by zombie movies. I mean, zombie movies aren't scary. Zombies aren't scary.
Right.
We're not scared of zombies anymore. Everyone knows how to kill a zombie. Everyone listening to this knows how to survive the zombie apocalypse. Everyone has a plan. The reason why people love zombie movies is because of what it does to the characters, and it puts these characters into horrible situations with, would you put a bullet in your own wife's head to prevent her from a terrible fate?
Right.
Like, would you do that? And that scares us. What would you do to save your kids?
Right.
What would you do to survive a few months longer in a zombie apocalypse? What horrible person would you become? That's the kind of story and kind of monster that fascinates me. And so I think about that kind of stuff, and invariably I end up with some kind of monsters. Because in the end, the monster was inside us all along.
Spoiler. I think that's a beautiful understanding. I have long.
So
said,
do I.
I've long believed that one of the scariest and most intense sequences in American film is in the Coen Brothers' Blood Simple film, not too far from here. The sequence where you have a character who is not a murderer, and he is a good guy. And he's being forced into a position where I either murder this person to protect my lover from being, going to jail, or I send her to jail and cannot make a decision. And that whole sequence of driving out into Texas night and having the shovel on the road, and that is an amazing sequence, and is exactly what you're saying. It's a person being put into a situation that is impossible, and we just watch it get more and more impossible until they snap. And then you see what's inside of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. Moving from horror, you have been working, you've been in London much of this last few months, working on Doctor Strange.
It's a small independent movie.
Small little movie with a bunch of no-names. But your writing partner, Scott Derrickson, is directing that. Talk a little bit about the experience, because I know you are admired as a writer, and you're admired as a writer who can adapt, whether it's comic books, novels, or video games as well.
Or slam poetry.
Or slam poetry. You're widely celebrated for the film versions of poems. But you're also, unlike many screenwriters, you are welcomed and invited to set. It's well known in Hollywood that many screenwriters are not allowed on set. They are not invited to contribute to a director's take, and they're not allowed to talk to the
actors.
Well,
the thing is,
they're allowed.
I mean, the WGA requires that a screenwriter be allowed to.
Oh, they are allowed. They're allowed.
Yeah, they're allowed. But they're not necessarily always invited to the creative process.
Which
I think is what you're really, really driving at.
Right, when the filming starts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, hey, come out and visit. But yeah, no, I have a very different relationship because my writing partner is the director.
Yes.
And because he so values my input as a writer, as a writing partner, he also values my taste and input while he's directing. So, he enjoys having me around, and I enjoy being around.